I'm Bill Giddings. I teach environmental science at Pacific Lutheran University, and I recently spent a year working in the environmental health lab at the University of Washington. I'd like to begin my session on pesticides and food safety with some disclaimers. I'm not a physician. I'm not a toxicologist. I'm not a statistician. I'm not a dietitian, a farmer, or a cook. So what I will try to do today is to serve as a reporter and interpreter of what the questions are regarding pesticides and food safety, and the variety of viewpoints that are expressed by qualified observers from the perspective of a sometime practicing scientist. And that scientific perspective is important in a review of a book called The Apocalyptics about this kind of issue. The reviewer comments that many are appalled by the apparent quarreling among scientists because they are unaware that such quarrels are the heart and soul of scientific progress. In a young field like risk analysis applied to a subject like this, contradictory data are the norm, not the exception. Disagreeing scientists aren't liars or malicious antagonists, or I might add, hired guns, but honest searchers for answers to hard questions. That's the way of science. Carcinogenesis, cancer formation, and the regulatory process illustrate the interaction of science, technology, and societal concerns. The situation is quite unlike such pure scientific inquiry as whether there's sufficient mass in the universe to lead to a cataclysmic collapse or whether the universe will expand indefinitely. If we find the answer to the latter, we can't do anything with the answer. But knowledge about the environment and human health allows, nay, requires us to take action. Such knowledge not only provides answers, it also raises new questions. For instance, in the case of pesticides, we must decide whether the benefits derived from a given substance are balanced by one additional cancer per 1,000 people or per 1,000,000 people or whatever. At this point, society as a whole must make decisions. The problem is not new. In the play The Enemy of the People, Henrik Ibsen relates how the villagers expel their neighbor who discovers that the local industry destroys the local environment. So, what we are talking about in the title, pesticides, the word side means literally kill. And pests, of course, are anything we don't want, at least in a particular place, in a particular time. So we may have insecticides to kill insects, rodenticides to kill mice, squirrels, or whatever else is chewing on your crops, fungicides to kill molds, avicides to kill birds, herbicides to kill other plants that we define as weeds. Well, when do you think pesticides came into widespread use? Anybody have a perspective on that one? I was actually surprised to read in going through my pile of material I brought up to prepare for this session that pesticides came into widespread use in U.S. agriculture over 100 years ago. Congress passed an Insecticide Act in 1910 to set the first standards for their use and for their effectiveness and to set up apparatus to regulate them. One of the prime insecticides of the early part of the century is lead arsenate, the combined poisonous effect of lead and of arsenic. And lead arsenate residues on apples was a controversial subject in the 1920s, I read. I don't remember. But the first, what chemists call organic, meaning based on the element carbon, insecticide was DDT in 1942, And DDT was credited with stopping a typhus epidemic that was being spread by insects in Europe at the close of the Second World War. In the 1950s and 60s in India, DDT was credited with cutting the death toll from malaria from 750,000 a year before DDT to 1,500 a year after DDT. And altogether, DDT may be credited as having saved more lives in insect-spread disease than penicillin or any other single substance. Then DDT was held responsible for the devastating effects observed on bird populations, particularly those at the top of the food chain, and was labeled a human carcinogen, and it was on that basis that it was banned for use in the United States, well, for almost all applications. There still were a few for which it was legal, since nothing else was available, in the year 1972. And also Europe followed pretty much the same ban at the same time. DDT is, however, still around. DDT can be measured in the flesh of gulls in the Great Lakes, in the soil, in earthworms, and in house dust. And DDT is very much in use in other parts of the world. In fact, the World Health Organization and the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations helped developing countries to build DDT factories. In 1963, Sri Lanka, using DDT, had 17 reported cases of malaria. Then they decided not to use it anymore, and in 1969 they had 2.5 million cases. So they went back to it. But there's a real problem. What happens, of course, is you don't kill all of the insects. And it's the strongest that survive and reproduce. And so by a process of natural selection, since insects go through so many generations so quickly, a population builds up that is resistant to that particular pesticide. So bigger doses are needed, and eventually even bigger doses become ineffective. Now, as far as the effect on the birds, there are some that claim that the problem of eggshells thinning that led to birds being unable to reproduce wasn't caused by DDT at all, but by PCBs, industrial chemicals made for other purposes. And I do believe that at the time, 1972, the methods of chemical analysis that were used for DDT could not distinguish between DDT and PCBs. But nobody was expecting PCBs to be spread all the way around the world, as they found it quite believable that DDT was. Others still say DDT is the problem, or a potential problem, where it is still around. Anyhow, both PCBs and DDT have been banned for quite some time. The bird populations are recovering. On the other hand, you have to be careful about concluding too much from that. For example, told that the number of storks in Europe is declining. We're also told that the birth rate in Europe is declining. But that doesn't mean that storks bring babies. Of course, it doesn't mean babies bring storks either. So, since DDT was banned in 1972, we've turned to using other kinds of pesticides, ones that are much more poisonous to humans. In the 10 years beginning in 1973, poisonings by pesticides in California increased 14% each year. The other pesticides are more expensive to make, and since they're purposely made to disappear from the environment quickly so they can't concentrate up the food chain and still be around 30 years later, like DDT, they have to be applied much more often. And so we can see why those countries where their population tends to starve to death before they live long enough to get cancer may still find the benefits of DDT to outweigh the risks. Until, of course, the resistant strains of insects develop and make that ineffective. And by the way, there is no direct evidence I've seen that this worldwide use of DDT over 50 years now has actually caused any cancers in humans, and of course there's no proof that it hasn't. Well, American companies have exported 120 million pounds of pesticides each year that are not registered for use in the United States. Some of these, of course, may come back to us in foods that we import from those countries. Now, by law, the foreign purchasers of these pesticides are supposed to be informed that this pesticide can't legally be used in the United States, but in practice that generally seems not to happen. So these unregistered pesticides include things that have been banned in the U.S. because of their presumed effects, but we should also recognize that unregistered pesticides in the U.S. include others that the manufacturers have withdrawn from the U.S. market because nobody was buying, and those that there simply is no market for in the U.S. because the crop may not be produced here or the particular insect pest in question may not be a problem here and may be a serious problem in other countries, other climates. However, it's estimated that 400,000 to 2 million pesticide poisonings do occur worldwide each year, mostly among farmers in third world countries. In the United States, the major risks of pesticides are considered to be to agricultural workers in the fields, to those who work making the pesticides, and to those who work applying them. Now, much pesticide use is not agricultural at all. I mentioned the use against insects that spread disease. Also, according to Time magazine this month, 40% of people's private lawns are treated with pesticides at 3 to 6 times the dose farmers use on their fields. The control of termites, carpenter ants, and fleas bring pesticides indoors in many homes. There's a story I read in two places that a former concert pianist and ice skater in suburban Chicago, River Grove, if any of you know where that is, claims that her health has been destroyed by pesticides that were being applied to her neighbor's lawn, which accidentally sprayed her. Her dog and her cat died that day. She's now legally blind in one eye, can't see very well out of the other, and has to walk with a cane. So compared to these nightmares, what about pesticides on the food we might buy? Both the Environmental Protection Agency and the Food and Drug Administration say that in the testing programs which they carry out, there's only a few percent of domestic fruits and vegetables, and maybe a few more percent of imported ones, on the order of 4%, that exceed the levels that are legally allowed of pesticide residues. And most of those that don't pass these tests don't pass because the amount of pesticide on it isn't approved for that particular fruit or vegetable, but the same amount would be perfectly legal on a different fruit or vegetable. So we're down to 1% or less that actually exceed the limits established to be a margin of safety for the consumer. Furthermore, washing, peeling, and cooking the food reduces the levels of those pesticides to something less than 1% of the levels that guidelines of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization and World Health Organization list as approved. Now, there is a difference in the United States as far as how regulations apply to foods that are processed and to foods that we buy raw. For processed food, the Delaney Clause, enacted in 1958, does not allow the presence of any additive, whether it's there intentionally or not, that has been shown to cause cancer in tests on animals. Now, of course, in that period of time, the level of these compounds that chemists can actually detect is 1/1,000,000th of the amount that could be detected when Representative Delaney got Congress to pass that regulation. That does not mean that we are now at 1,000,000,000 times more risk, because we have 1,000,000,000 times as good information. The EPA would like to change that requirement of zero tolerance so that amounts that give a risk of less than, say, 1 in 1,000,000 be permitted as insignificant residues rather than zero, because the meaning of zero changes so rapidly as the ability to identify 1 in 1,000,000,000, 1 in 1,000,000,000,000 parts of a particular material become developed. Monday afternoon, we talked about how the risk analysis process is done that could lead to a judgment of 1 in 1,000,000 risk. It requires much experimental information, the use of elaborate computer models, and of assumptions that cannot be directly tested in order to give answers that have a wide range of probability. So with the risk analysis procedure, we might say, for example, that somewhere between 0 and 250 people in the United States might get cancer if they had a lifetime of exposure to the maximum amount of pesticide that is allowed on the food they eat, and this would come out as about a 1 in 1,000,000 risk. Now, note this is somewhere between 0 and 250 people. The 250 represents the highest believable odds against you, not what's considered to be most likely. And this is for the maximum exposure. Well, after we'd spent an hour on Monday discussing risk analysis and all of its uncertainties, one of the group commented it hardly seemed worth the effort. But on the other hand, without risk analysis, all we could say is that somewhere between nobody and everybody will get cancer from whatever it is you want to name. Well, from what I read, one important aspect of toxicology is that the dose makes the poison. Too much salt, for example, can be fatal, especially to infants. On the other hand, so can too little. Vitamin A is necessary for our health, but taking 5 times the recommended daily allowance of vitamin A in supplements can cause headaches, nosebleeds, liver damage, birth defects with mental disturbances with long-time chronic use. And there are similar situations for various minerals that are essential, like selenium, for example. A few years ago, the major headline in our Tacoma paper was selenium, the natural danger in your dinner. Something like 4 times the minimum level needed can be poisonous. And they're talking here about selenium that nobody purposely puts on the crop, but that it picks up in the soil from particular places. So toxicity, including whether something can cause cancer or not, isn't a yes or no question, as the Delaney Clause of 30 years ago presupposes that it is. Well, to get down to the specifics of the topic as stated, 6 months ago, Chemical and Engineering News, which is the news magazine of the American Chemical Society that has over 100,000 chemists as members, published a forum, considerable length, on risk assessment of pesticides. A letter to the editor later commented that the next article points out that the American Chemical Society can no longer provide professional liability insurance to its members, and there may be some connection. Anyhow, in this forum, 5 prominent figures were invited to present their views on the issue, and I will presume to summarize each in a few sentences. The first one, as one might expect if they've done much reading on the subject in either the popular or the technical press, was Bruce Ames. He's a biochemist at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the inventor of what's called the Ames test, which is used to screen substances that to see whether they might potentially cause cancer. So presumably he knows something about the field. And for at least 8 years, in what I have in my files, he's been maintaining that our diet contains 10,000 times as much of nature's pesticides. These are plant materials that have evolved in the plant in order to protect it from disease or pests. 10,000 times as much of these natural pesticides as any synthetic ones that are added by human activity. And that, he maintains...
10,000 times in what measure? 10,000 times as many grams? Or the 10,000 times as dangerous?
Well, 10,000 times as many grams is what the figure compares. Then he goes on to say that natural compounds are as likely as synthetic ones to be carcinogens. Of course, you don't test everything. There are 75,000 compounds that are in widespread use. But of the things that are tested, it seems that about half of either may tend to cause cancer at very high doses in experimental animals, which is the usual way of doing the test. Cooking food has been shown to produce chemicals that weren't there originally that may tend to cause cancer, particularly charcoal broiled meats, for example, or things fried at a very high temperature. He further maintains that the animal tests that are done, although he quotes their results for the natural ones as well as the synthetic ones, greatly exaggerate the risks by taking this worst case scenario rather than something that's a reasonable representation of what an individual might face. And there are, without a doubt, many cancer causing compounds as well as other kinds of poisons that are perfectly natural. Article from our local paper a year ago pointed out that comfrey tea, sold in health food stores, its safety is classified by the Food and Drug Administration as undefined, but it contains a compound that has induced liver cancer in rats and can poison the liver. Perhaps the cautionary proverb among those who gather wild mushrooms says it best: there are old mushroom hunters, there are bold mushroom hunters, but there are no old, bold mushroom hunters. So just because something is natural by no means indicates that it is safe. The good news, though, from Bruce Ames is that food also contains many anti-carcinogens, natural compounds that tend to protect you against cancer. And the selenium that is this natural danger, according to the newspaper, has been shown to have protective effect against other things that might cause cancer, as has the vitamin A that is so toxic in overdose, and many, many other things. And since there is, in fact, no magic difference between what's natural and what's made synthetically, the same protection applies of the natural anti-carcinogens against something that might be put into your food from human sources that could be dangerous to you. And so he thinks that the concern about pesticides in food is greatly overrated and in fact may be very counterproductive, because other than giving up smoking, he feels that the best protection against cancer is eat more fruits and vegetables that have these natural cancer protective ingredients in them. And if you're afraid to eat them because of a little pesticide, you may be putting yourself at far greater risk than if you go ahead and eat lots of them, which is what your body needs for health as well as protection against cancer. So that's position number one. Position number two in the same forum: the next pair of authors represent the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, a institution of the U.S. government. And they say that synthetic chemical pesticides are essential now for agriculture as we do it, to the extent that over 1 million pounds are used each year, and that's 4 pounds for every citizen of the United States. However, they point out the problem of insects developing resistance I've already talked about, and the corresponding tendency to use more of pesticides that are more poisonous. And the use of all of these haven't stopped the increase of crop losses to insects from going up in 40 years from 7% then to 14% now, as compared to something like 30% worldwide. Point out that 97 to 99% of the pesticide spray never reaches the target organisms. It's spread out all over the countryside. And they believe that there is considerable evidence that exposure to some pesticides does present real cancer risks. That laboratory tests on animals are, in spite of Bruce Ames' concern, very valuable indicators of human risks, and there are also epidemiological studies of how many cancers are observed in farm workers as again compared to other people who don't work in the fields. That indicates some pesticides do cause cancer in humans. Third was from the vice president of Monsanto Agricultural Company. He points out that the self-service gas pumps that people seem to use quite willingly to save so much per gallon warn that long-term exposure to those gasoline vapors has caused cancer in laboratory animals. That's correct, it has. But people don't seem to worry about that, so why do they worry so much about the pesticides on food? He says it's partly because of frenzied publicity. Says some estimate that food production would decline 40 to 50% without pesticides. And he points out quite correctly that there are 100,000 times as many cases of bacterial contamination, mold contamination, or insect contamination as there is of pesticide contamination. And indeed, pesticides may be very helpful in cutting down on the much greater risk of these natural biological contaminants, as in the joke, what's the catch of the day? Hepatitis. He also points out the difference that the use of herbicides, which are ton for ton far more used than insecticides, have made the difference in freeing people from the tyranny of having to hoe the weeds. And quotes with approval the chief of the Environmental Protection Agency, William Riley, who before he had that job headed the World Wildlife Fund, as saying, I think it is time to start taking aim before we open fire on health risks. The fourth authors represent environmental foundations, including the World Wildlife Fund, and begin their article by saying, ask blundering questions, provide weak answers, generate bad policies. That is the pathway along which public policies on pesticide regulation have trod. That is where they are likely to remain headed unless the research and policy community step back to take a clearer view of possible pesticide risks to health and the environment. Then they go on to say that the questions in the forum and the questions addressed by the regulations are the wrong questions. Limiting the focus to cancer and pesticide residues on food obscures the most serious parts of the total problem. It ignores the wildlife impact of doses of pesticides that are far too small to induce cancer in the wildlife, in the laboratory mouse, or in the human being, but do show up as effects on the immune system, the nervous system, the endocrine system, causing developmental problems in wildlife in generations beyond those which were exposed, and that you still do find DDT and many other pesticides and other toxic materials like PCBs in the flesh of, say, gulls in the Great Lakes area. The exposure to the area spraying of pesticides may, for some people, be far greater than anything they get on their food. Many places spray in the summer to keep the mosquitoes down, and Los Angeles, again, has been spraying this spring in residential areas to cut down or try to eliminate the Mediterranean fruit fly or med fly, which could be disastrous to the agricultural industry of California if its population exploded. Furthermore, use of pesticides for agriculture, forestry, and your neighbor's lawn and garden may drift and cause you exposure much greater than you'd ever get through your food. So don't just look at such a narrow question. They say the whole problem's a lot bigger than that. And the last word is given to the Environmental Protection Agency Office of Pesticide Programs. EPA does not believe that there is an imminent health crisis from the use of pesticides. They say that it was not a realistic portrayal of risks of EDB in 1984, LR in 1989, to imply that children might get cancer if they eat another muffin or another apple. Both of those formulations have been withdrawn from the market, not allowed to be used, because they judge that the lifetime cancer risk at the extreme of exposure was unacceptable. That besides pesticides helping with the efficient production of food and fiber and public health disease control that we've talked about, and reducing aggravation from mosquitoes or lice or fleas or whatever, they're used to kill germs in swimming pools and in the water supply. They're used to disinfect food preparation areas, including our Holden Village kitchen. They must be, according to health department regulations. They're used to sterilize surgical instruments and in many ways make life much safer for all of us. Before EPA will let a new pesticide go on the market, they evaluate the risk of eating residues on food, the risk of exposure to farm workers, of toxicity to fish and birds, the potential to contaminate wells and water supplies. They require data on short-term poisonous effects as well as long-term ones like cancer or birth defects. They explore what happens in the environment to the residues after these are applied. However, they only look at pesticides that are already in use when new concerns arise, and they'll take them off the market if they judge the risks are unacceptably high. But now, for recent new regulations, laws passed by Congress, they will have to go through a re-registration process for all the pesticides that have been in use for a long time, when the kind of data that are now required weren't even available, let alone required when those pesticides were first allowed to be used. The thousands of poisonings that do occur are from accidents, from carelessness, from failure to follow directions or regulations. For one example, back in 1985, over 300 people in the West Coast were made ill over the 4th of July weekend from eating watermelons that were contaminated with the insecticide. Aldicarb is the generic name, Temic was the brand name. Nobody died from that, but they got kind of sick, and that was never approved to be used on watermelons. They prosecuted people that are considered to have used it, its primary use in California is on cotton that we don't expect to eat. They believe that the concern people have about pesticides on food goes beyond what we know about the risks. Much of the concern is based on what we don't know about the risks. And so they do the risk assessment on a worst case scenario to allow for these unknown factors and for the extra effects you may have from being exposed to several different things at the same time, which could add up to a greater risk than just adding the individual ones if somehow they manage to work together. The law requires that EPA do a risk-benefit analysis before canceling or suspending the use of a chemical unless it's considered to be a crisis situation, and that process takes months or years. They give top priority now to improving the scientific basis for the regulatory decisions, to preventing pollution, and to communicating risk information to the public. Then at the end of the forum are 8 pages of rebuttal showing that none of these people has made a case that convinces any of the others. So what we're faced with is something about the uncertainty of science, quoting from Lewis Thomas, who is President Emeritus of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, as well as a well-known writer on science and medical questions. The great body of science, built like a vast hill over the past 300 years, is a mobile, unsteady structure made up of solid enough bits of information, but with all the bits always moving about, fitting together in different ways, adding new bits to themselves with flourishes of adornment as though consulting a mirror, giving the whole arrangement something like the unpredictability and unreliability of living flesh. Human knowledge doesn't stay put. It evolves by what we call trial and error, or, as is more usually the sequence, error and trial. So the questions of this sort are also available for humorists. I didn't really mind the cyanide-laced grapes or the chickens tainted with heptachlor, carcinogenic cousin of DDT. Bobbing for Alar? What fun. A tuna mercury casserole is okay as long as it has potato chips crumbled on top, and I figure ketchup detoxifies a hormone burger. It was no big deal to learn that the Maillard reaction, the heated exchange between sugars and amino acids that browns cookies, breads, and meats, also produces stuff that can cause genetic mutations. And I wasn't even alarmed when the New York Times suggested washing all fruits and vegetables in ivory soap. I'll just send my salads out to be dry cleaned. But when researchers at the University of Wisconsin recently announced that Cheese Whiz was a potential cancer fighter, my hide was fried to a golden mutagenic crisp. Our food, humorist friend Leibowitz once observed, is an important part of a well-balanced diet. Food can kill you, but not as quick as no food at all. So I've been talking too long. I do have one case in point I will go into if there's not something that is more urgent on your minds, but I do want to give you the opportunity to share the confusion I've carefully delivered here. Well, the one case, as referred to in that humor piece, is that of trade name Alar, generic name Dimenazide. In 1989, first I want to ask if there's anyone here who's in the apple business and has some firsthand knowledge of that situation. Considering where we're located, I thought that might be a fairly likely possibility, but no one who wants to rise to that. Then I will summarize what I understand about it. First of all, Alar isn't a pesticide. but that's a matter of definition. Alar isn't put on the apple to kill anything. It's put on the apple to keep the red apples on the tree longer so they can get redder and crisper and they'll can be stored longer before they turn mushy. It's a growth regulator. 1985, EPA began proceedings to cancel Alar because they thought that it might be too high a cancer risk, but then concluded that the experiments on which that judgment might be based were not good enough to make a judgment on. In 1989, the Natural Resources Defense Council charged that EPA's risk analysis for Alar underestimated the amount of apples, apple juice, and applesauce that children consumed, seriously underestimated that, and that 6,000 preschool children might get cancer, not from the Alar itself, but from what it turns into in the processing, in the cooking particularly, or in the body. Now that 6,000 might be compared with the 5.5 million children that might be expected to get cancer anyway, since a quarter of the population does. But EPA's risk analysis had given a risk 25 times lower. They thought that risk was still too high, and were going to start proceedings towards removing the registration for Alar, but they didn't consider it an emergency, and so they were going through the process of studying the matter, which would take 18 months or so, to get the best possible information before doing the ban. 60 Minutes presented two broadcasts on the subject that beginning of 1989. Meryl Streep testified before Congress. There were reports of things like a state patrol chasing down a school bus in order to confiscate an apple from a lunchbox by request of a terrified parent. The apple processors experienced crippling loss of sales, $132 million in this state, $100 million in other states, because people quit buying apples. The sole manufacturer of Alar, Uniroyal Corporation, maintains that the recent studies have shown that Alar and its breakdown product are not in fact carcinogenic, nor do they cause mutations, and charges that the NRDC based their analysis on a 1973 study that's since been invalidated. TreeTop Corporation, the largest producer of apple juice, refused to make juice from apples treated with Alar. Uniroyal then voluntarily stopped selling Alar in the United States for food crops while still maintaining that there was no problem other than nobody would buy it. And they recalled and gave refunds for stocks that were registered for food use. A little Alar is still available for use on ornamental plants, but not legally to be used on food in this country. Still can be abroad. The EPA did go through their 18-month process, actually a little longer than that. It was May 31st of 1991 that they eliminated any allowances for Alar residues in produce, whether it's grown in this country, where Alar hasn't legally been used for 2 years, or whether it's imported from abroad. So the brochure you'll find on the rack going into the dining room, labeled Pesticides in Children's Food, Mothers and Others for Pesticide Limits, a project of the Natural Resources Defense Council, is without a doubt out of date. It talks about the hazard from deminazide, which is, as I say, Alar, and whatever the hazard is or may have been, it's not there now, at least as far as if people do what they're supposed to do. An ironic footnote, because of that concern and because of the way the tests were reported, A test of for LR content of U.S. grapefruit was reported that they contain half a part per million or less. What that means is, unless there was at least half a part per million, they couldn't find any. So it's a negative result. None is found, but you can't prove there's none there. However, South Korean consumer groups picked that up as saying there might be half a part per million and launched a boycott effort. LR isn't used on grapefruit. And they just hope that after the Korean government declared U.S. grapefruit were safe, that the Korean public would buy it again. So, where does this leave you? You tell me. Yes?
It's my understanding that there's a law, I think currently before Congress, to prohibit the export of any pesticides that are illegal in the United States.
I believe
and
that's the
I
case.
I wondered if you'd care to comment on what you think the implications of that is, both good and bad, with respect to people in foreign countries.
Well, the good implications are things that we consider to be too dangerous for our own people are probably too dangerous for other people as well. I qualify that as probably, though, because, again, the risks and benefits are different. If starvation is something that threatens a third to half your population, then the benefits may exceed the risks. Whereas in this country, that's not the case, and we have the luxury of paying much more attention to the risks. And there's no question but what the risk of cancer goes up with age for reasons that have nothing really to do with what we eat necessarily. On the other hand, this means that for those situations where there's no reason to even try to sell it in this country, but maybe good reason for them to need it, and it may be just as safe, they have to get it someplace else, they couldn't get it from here. There's no question but what the information transmission is ineffective. Particularly the user in the other country may not be able to understand at all what the situation is. Of course, the user in this country may not be able to either, but it's a lot less likely if you have a lower level of education and a different language where the translation, if available, might not be that good. There's also a bit of paternalism in that, saying we should make the decisions for foreign countries as to what risks and benefits they should be allowed to choose for themselves. So I've tried to give the various sides of it, and then of course the public health question can be entirely different there from here. Many insect-borne diseases like malaria are not a problem here. They can be devastating in other countries.
Isn't a lot of it though economics? I mean, the real goal is for the producer of those chemicals to make money. And obviously selling their products is important, but I think it's also unfortunate that the people that have the greatest risk of exposure are Spanish-speaking farm workers.
Yes.
Who don't know what they're up against. And I think there's a real justice issue that the pesticide manufacturers are relatively safe.
Yeah, there's no question but what there's a justice issue, that the risks are not borne by the same people that get the benefits. I think that's true in every area, not only our society, but most societies that I'm aware of, at least. And there's no question but what there are risks. Well, to the manufacturer's personnel and to the agricultural personnel, and that those who stand to benefit may ignore the legal requirements. I had a long conversation a little over a year ago with one of my former students who is now in a responsible position in the California Department of Agriculture. And he maintains, sincerely believes, that the regulations which the California Department of Agriculture has in effect are protective of the workers. But of course, no one can police every application. And there is a great deal of uncertainty as to how safe is safe. There's no such thing as zero risk, but how safe, what is a reasonable level of risk or an acceptable level of risk is a social decision. And the people bearing the risk may not be empowered to make the decision, as you point out. Of course, you do have to pay more to get less. If you want to buy food that is guaranteed not to have had pesticides used on it or synthetic fertilizers used on it, then the word organic is used to mean that in that context. And although it's hard to know whether it's a valid claim or not, this is available many places, but at a higher price.
It is creating a new market.
It's creating a new market.
I mean, and it's creating an economic structure for a small, at least in the Willamette Valley, there's a lot of small farmers that are producing organically grown products. Mm-hmm. Where it doesn't make sense, but it didn't exist. It's changing farming a little bit.
Right, and I'm not either prepared nor have we time to talk about alternatives to pesticides. What can you do instead and still raise crops at a reasonable price, maybe not the same price? And there is, I'll just say that there is not only from the small entrepreneur who sees an opportunity or who has a personal moral stance that requires them to go in that direction, but agriculture generally and governmental programs and schools of agriculture programs are moving much more to use of less pesticide, less often, find out when in the life cycle of the insect it's really needed and vulnerable and spray then rather than spraying by the calendar often and early and late, and use of biological controls, natural predators which may be poisoned by the pesticide and what some other insect, bird or whatever that could keep the population at a reasonable level may be wiped out in the past year after, may get worse as a result of spray. How to avoid that sort of thing and other biological attacks on the problem that work in some cases but take a lot of time and money to develop before they can be put in use. Yeah.
Would you say that, did you say 4 pounds per person?
Yeah.
Of pesticides?
Mm-hmm.
Per year? Would that include all the herbicide, fungicide, rodenticide?
Yeah,
that's insecticide.
Yeah, that's based on total amounts sold of all of these things.
Have you seen anything that says if we didn't use that, what would our food supply be? And would we be able to?
Well, there was the Monsanto vice president that said that it could be 40 or 50% crop losses if we didn't use any of those.
Loss, but then also whether it's market to it's.
Yeah,
production to consumption, and so how much of it would be eaten by rodents? And
well, I don't know of any experiments that would give a good basis for making that calculation, nor have I seen one in print. What I happened to read.
The 4 pounds, is that what was actually applied, or the amount that's actually consumed?
Well, that's what's sold. And the assumption is that in the long run, at least, people don't buy it unless they're going to use it, I guess.
So that much is actually on the fruit or vegetable or whatever you're eating?
Or the golf course, or
it seems like it. I mean,
the forest, the spruce trees. It's not all food crops by any means.
Yeah.
But that you were saying?
Well, just that during that preparation process, you lose. Is that including how much is lost during the preparation, or what? That's what you're actually buying.
Oh, no. Well, that's what's actually being used. And again, most of it never hits the insect or whatever. Of course, a lot of it never hits the part of the crop you eat either. It goes on the stalk or the husk or the ground or into the water supply. But that's another question. Yeah. Yes?
Yeah, I was going to mention one thing. You notice that this is a little bit off the subject, but agriculture in itself is not a normal environmental situation. For example,
quite
if you're
correct.
Growing a forest of Douglas fir trees and you don't allow a climatic succession.
Right.
So if you're growing all these trees that are the same type, genotype, mm-hmm. and so on, in a normal forest system, I don't know, but I'm speculating that there would be some protections by having these trees interspersed with other plant life, fungicides, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't have that situation in nature. So you're not talking about something that you have in nature in agriculture. You know, agriculture is a very artificial situation. You're trying to maintain a stand of identical plants in very close range.
As far as the eye can see and farther.
Like wheat or
trees.
And so when you're saying that you're applying insecticides to something, you're forgetting that the whole thing's artificial anyway. Because in nature you don't see huge stands of genetically mm-hmm. identical individuals. You know, you have a wide range of genetically different plants, slightly different plants, and you have a lot of things going on that you don't have going on in the field that you planted for human use. So you might want to think about looking at it in a different point of view.
Yeah.
You're not dealing with a natural
system. Absolutely correct.
A highly artificial system. And
it's also a system that is set up for the maximum advantage of the insect to spread and devastate.
Exactly. It's perfect for a setup.
For the disease.
For a predator or insect.
The mold, whatever it is.
So
thank you for that.
The activity itself is causing the problem, and therefore mm-hmm. to say, no, you can't use pesticides, is really dodging the problem, because you've caused the problem.
Right. There's, again, it's a problem of focusing on too narrow an issue.
Yeah,
thank you
exactly.
for that.
What are the byproducts of producing most of these chemicals? Are there a lot of hazardous wastes produced in the production byproducts? Or?
Well, there are some, like 2,4-5-T, that aren't allowed to be produced because of the byproduct, not the pesticide itself. The dioxin. And that's something that I'll say a little bit about tomorrow when we talk about incineration for waste disposal, because that's another place that this can maybe be produced. But you're right, the whole process of production makes a lot of other things besides what you're after making, which may be a much worse problem than what you're really setting out to do. Yeah.
Do you know how much, now, are swimming pool chemicals included in this?
Sure, in that case, the pest is bacteria.
So, do you know how much we're using now as compared to 5 years ago or 10 years ago?
No, I really don't. I mean, the quantity is small compared to what's used in the commercial farms or forests. because there aren't that many swimming pools. But of course, in municipal water supplies, a lot more is used, and has to be, for the protection of public health.
If people are arguing about that too, you know, they say, mm-hmm. well, we shouldn't chlorinate the water. Instead, we should go to some other process which is less harmful. There are some other ones that
right.
are used.
And it's quite correct that your wastewater treatment plant, the chlorination step, is like a little pesticide factory just before you let it loose in the environment. So many things we could talk about, but I'm sure the tape is up and it's almost time to go eat if we dare. Thank you.